This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. After the attacks in Paris last week, government officials here have said that encryption can be a roadblock in obtaining information about these terrorist plots. They've called for broadening their abilities to unlock encrypted messages and devices. CIA Director John Brennan addressed this issue at a global security forum just 3 days after the attacks.
There are a lot of technological capabilities that are available right now that make it exceptionally difficult, both technically as well as legally, for intelligence security services to have the insight they need to uncover it. And I do think this is a time for particularly Europe, as well as here in the United States, for us to take a look and see whether or not there have been some inadvertent or intentional gaps that have been created in the ability of intelligence and security services to protect the people that they are asked to serve.
That was CIA Director John Brennan speaking earlier in the week. Now, would expanding the government's ability to crack open encrypted messages make for better surveillance? How do you balance national security and privacy? Well, my next guests are here to talk about that. Matt Blaze is director of the Distributed Systems Lab at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He joins us here in our CUNY studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
I'm glad to be here.
Patrick Skinner is the director of special project at the SUFAN Group. He's also a former CIA case director. Our phone number, if you want to participate, is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me start with you, Matt. Officials working on the case are, of course, they're still piecing together how the whole plan came together. How good is encryption of all these messages? They used an app called Telegram, supposedly, and it encrypts things. How good is encryption on these types of apps?
Well, first of all, we don't actually know much about what the Paris terrorists were actually using to communicate. In fact, a lot of the evidence that's come out so far suggests that they were just communicating back and forth on Facebook and weren't using any encryption apps at all. But, you know, it's conceivable that they could have been. What encryption is good at when it's implemented properly, and that's a pretty big if, is hiding the contents of messages from somebody who intercepts the communication. What it's not good at doing is hiding the presence of the communication in the first place or the identities of who's talking to who. It's also not good at protecting communications if you can go after the endpoint computer or phone or whatever it is that they're using. So encryption is pretty good at protecting data in transit, but it has it's not a one-stop shopping communication security solution.
Mm-hmm. Now, Apple, the iPhone maker, has been having a running battle with the government about encryption because its stuff stays in its iPhone encrypted, right? How does that work?
Well, what Apple recently did was make a few changes to the way that they encrypt data that's stored on the iPhone handsets. And that basically makes it more difficult, if it's configured in a particular way, for someone who doesn't know the passcode to recover data that's stored on the phone. And that's assuming that the person has physical possession of the phone and is trying to extract data off of it. So it's a little bit different from the problem of encrypting messages that are going back and forth over the network.
Mm-hmm. And Apple still is insisting on keeping.
Well, one of the problems is, and you hinted at this earlier when you talked about the question of security versus privacy, that's part of this question. But there's another and probably much more important aspect of the question, which is that we rely on encryption for our own security. We are using the internet for just about every aspect of our daily lives, of our commercial lives, for our critical infrastructure. And encryption is one of the important technologies that lets us protect those things.
Yeah. Patrick Skinner, how much does encryption and these consumer apps really hinder intelligence agencies? Is more data the answer?
No, I actually don't think more data is the answer. In your previous clip of CIA Director Brennan, he mentioned that they needed insight. But I think that's a confusion between more data and insight. The Paris attacks show that we have all the information. And in fact, we have way more information than we can process. And what we've done with all this data collection is build the world's most accurate hindsight machine. We can quickly determine what happened, but we're still unable to prevent it. So I don't think that encrypted apps, I mean, it's the scare of the month. And there are some valid concerns, but that's not the root problem.
Huh. I mean, would that explain how they were so able to quickly go to Saint-Denis and track down where those terrorists were hiding because they have so much data to work with already?
Yes. I mean, they're called known wolves of terror for a reason. They already know who these people are. They just operate right under the radar. And the Saint-Denis raid was actually an unencrypted cell phone. They were tracking the cousin, the female cousin of Abu Ad. And so, I mean, encryption could play a role, but it doesn't appear to have played a role in this or any other major plot.
So why do people keep asking for more encryption if you say they have so much? Let me throw this out to both of you, Matt and Patrick.
Well, I think there are two... there are two debates going on, and it's probably helpful to separate them. Law enforcement agencies in the United States have been warning that encryption will hinder their ability to investigate past crimes, mm-hmm. to do forensic analysis of phones and so forth. But that's very different from the problem of tracking terrorist activity. When the intelligence agencies warn about the use of encryption causing them to go dark with terrorists, I wonder sometimes whether what they're you know saying is, oh, please don't throw us into the briar patch. We would hate that if they used more encryption and used more of this secure communication, because you know I wonder if the availability of encryption tools encourages our adversaries to make more use of electronic communication where the metadata, the presence of the communication, can be tracked in ways that other types of communication, like sending messages back and forth with couriers,
yeah.
would be much harder to track. So I think this may be a boon for intelligence, but they'll never say that publicly.
Is that right? Patrick Skinner, does this make a case then that we need more effective surveillance people? You know, people on the ground?
Yeah, we certainly need to combine more human intelligence, human sources that will provide context to the information that we're collecting. If you continually collect everything, you literally know nothing. And so we need more analysis. More surveillance cameras only will have more angles of the explosion. You need more people to understand before it happens. The encryption debate, and I actually agree that it could be that the government saying, oh, please, don't use these invulnerable apps to... And that, you know, they'll never admit it, but then they would be able to track the chatter a lot easier.
Hmm. So it's sort of a don't do it, but I'm really hoping that you do it because I say don't do it.
Exactly. I mean, and it's correct. I mean, it's hard to break it if you physically have it. If I have something with TrueCrypt on my computer, it's hard for you to physically break it, but I'm assuming you have my computer. Mm-hmm. But the... communications in transit, that still leaves some kind of trail. And that we're missing the obvious stuff. We shouldn't even worry about encryption yet. We're missing, you know, really obvious right. unencrypted stuff.
You know, Matt, intelligence agencies have always talked about having what's called a backdoor. We need a backdoor to get into these encryption. Would backdoors help?
Well, that sounds from a policy point of view like such a perfect solution. Unfortunately, there's one fundamental problem with that, which is that we simply don't know how to do that in anything close to a secure way. We are in what I think everyone would agree is effectively a crisis in our network and cybersecurity infrastructure. You know, we hear about things like critical infrastructure being weak. We hear about things like the OPM database breach. You know, literally every week. It only makes headlines if it's something on the scale of the OPM breach. One of the very few technologies that can help, and it won't help 100%, but it gets us some part of the way there. Is the widespread use of encryption where it's possible to use it. When we include backdoors in these systems, we create a very, very real and very practical risk that those backdoors will be available not just to the good guys, but also to the bad guys.
Hmm. Oh, you agree, Patrick?
I actually do. As somebody who just got my letter from the OPM hack saying that all my personal detail and fingerprints were lifted, I don't think that I would want the U.S. government to have this ultimate master key that could unlock everything. Because one, it does weaken the encryption. I don't know how you make encryption stronger by putting a back door in it. But also, the fact that the government is made of people and we're failable, and it's, you know, entirely feasible and more likely probable that mistakes will happen and they'll just leak it again.
Well, I have you two hacking experts here. I have to ask you this question about the hacker group Anonymous said it was going to be shutting down the ISIS accounts. Could these have any effect on intercepting some of the terrorist messages? Can they hack into their message system at all? Matt, what do you think?
I think there's more to counterterrorism than just the electronic side of it. So, while perhaps the Anonymous group has its heart in the right place, I suspect there's more to it than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's more of a whack-a-mole strategy where they're shutting down individual accounts. Actually, increasing reporting to Telegram or Facebook or whatever is pretty effective. It causes them to shut down. They'll open up again, but it is a pain to keep having to ensure that your followers know who you are as you close accounts.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll keep following this. I want to thank both of you gentlemen for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Belays is director of the Distributed Systems Lab at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Patrick Skinner, director of special projects at the SUFAN Group. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how science could help us untangle those strange subway maps you see all over the world. London, Moscow, New York. It's the science and art of map design. We'll talk about how maybe you can make it better so you can follow those little squiggly spaghetti lines on the map. We'll talk about it after the break. Maybe you're going away for the holidays and need some direction. We might be able to help you. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, every once in a while an idea so revolutionary erupts, so basic, that when you see it, you say, why didn't somebody think of that before? Well, that's what I said when I got my first look at a radical new subway map of New York City. It's not the official map, but an idea in which the multicolored subway lines, they don't thread through the city like lost strands of spaghetti. They don't defy you to trace their winding ways with an outstretched finger. But rather, they flow smoothly and predictably to and from their destinations in an easy-to-read typeface. And this experimental map showed New York subway as a circle. Yeah, how many different ways can you make a subway map? How can we make them all better? It's just one of the ideas scientists have put forward for improving transit map design. Can we use what we've learned about human vision to make maps more readable? You know, you're in the subway, you're running by the map, you want to see where you're going, the train's coming. Can you take a quick look at it? Can we make a map that's better to look quickly at and cut the time down? Can we run test figures to figure out what actually helps people on their journey from point A to point B? Well, my next guests are tackling those questions and more, so let me introduce them. Ruth Rosenholz is a principal research scientist in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT. She joins us from Cambridge. Welcome, Ruth.
Hi, Ira.
Thank you. Max Roberts is a transit map researcher and lecturer in psychology at the University of Essex in the UK. He also designed a few maps himself, and he joins us from London. Welcome, Max.
Hello, Ira.
Two great cities with two great subway systems. And we want to ask our listeners if they have any idea. If you have an idea how to make your local transit map better, easier to use, or can you suggest maps that you think hit that sweet spot between simplicity and complexity, give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Max, you designed that circular New York subway map that I was talking about. How did you get an idea to make it into a circle?
I started off in London. In London, they'd open up a brand new sort of circular line around the outskirts of central London. And there were people sort of trying out circles, and I thought they weren't doing it very well. So I tried something a bit more disciplined with perfect circles centered on one spot and spokes all radiating from one single place. And then I was astonished at the response I got in London. I was expecting all to say, oh, you've messed about with the map. That's horrible. Take it away. But in fact, a large number of people loved it. And I then sort of went on a world journey trying the map on different cities worldwide.
Hey, you know, even and that's great because even seasoned subway people like myself, you're standing there, and you know, New York City subways, it's like literally like spaghetti. You're trying to trace which train goes from New York to Brooklyn, whatever, and you can't really see it. And if you're in a rush, it's incredible. But Ruth, is that really reason enough to change a map because you want to save 5 minutes?
Well, it's a good question. There's a lot of different criteria that go into making something a good map or not a good map. There's things you could do from a human perception point of view to make it easier to quickly glance at the map and tell where you need to go.
What makes a transit map design different? You specialize, Ruth, in how we look at things, peripheral vision. When we look on a map, are we really using peripheral vision?
Oh, absolutely. And you can get an easy sense of this if you just poke a hole in a piece of paper and try, finding the path from one stop to another one that you need to go to. If you're only allowed to look through that hole in the piece of paper, it would be quite challenging.
Yeah.
About 99% of your visual field is peripheral, so you use it for a lot more than you're usually conscious of.
Right. And Max, what makes a transit map design different than, let's say, a regular above-ground cartography map?
Well, the map's trying to show you efficiently how everything's connected together. So in theory, you know your start and destination station, and you've got to sort of try and plan the route as quickly as possible, most efficient way possible. I always say a standard geographical map shows you where the network is, but a good diagram shows you how the network works together.
Yeah. And Ruth, you spend a lot of time figuring out what stuff looks like in our peripheral vision. You said punch a hole in a piece of paper. Is that what you do, or do you do something a little more complex than that?
We certainly do introspect on what we see, and we certainly have punched holes in paper and actually looked at subway maps that way just to convince ourselves that you really did use peripheral vision. But for instance, another exercise you can do to get a sense of what peripheral vision is like, because we're not used to introspecting on our own peripheral vision, is you could say, for instance, hold your hand up. I would say your open hand, so your fingers are extended, and then look a little bit to one side of your hand, but then concentrate on your hand and look at what you see. And it can be quite a jumble. You know, you can't really see the shape of your hand. For me, my fingers it's not clear which finger attaches to which part of my hand. And yet I can see the wrinkles on the back of my fingers and so on. So I'm getting lots of little detail, but it's jumbled and messed up somehow.
Hmm. How did you end up applying your peripheral vision model to transit maps?
Well, in general, in my lab, we have sort of two things we're interested in. We're interested in just the basic science of human vision, which these days mostly means peripheral vision. But we're also interested in applying that to real-world problems like design. And transit maps are so cool for exactly the reasons that you've been saying. They can be really complex, and you're sort of allowed to design them in so many different ways, and they two people could do two completely different maps for the same transit system, which means there's a really rich place to study whether or not that design makes any difference.
Yeah, and there have been a lot of designs of transit maps. Max, you say that putting transit maps to a public vote, which one do we like to show people maps, might be the worst thing that a city could do.
Definitely. I've done lots of studies, and every single study, the correlation, you can measure people's opinions and you can measure real usability, accuracy, time to plan, time to find stations. And every single study I've ever run, the correlation between people's opinions on how good a map is and how good it really is a zero. So people choose maps that they like, maps that they expect to see, maps which conform to how they think a good map should be designed. And sometimes that gets in the way if it's a map that's how they expect it to be, but it's actually very badly designed.
Of all the major metropoli, which map is there a map that sort of works the best?
I've never seen a map I haven't wanted to fix somehow. There are some maps which are quite nice, generally for sort of smaller cities. I like the BART map in San Francisco. That's quite a nice, clean design. And the St. Petersburg always comes up with good maps. But mostly cities I see, there's some pretty bad maps out there.
Yeah. Well,
I really like, you've mentioned Max's sort of circular maps, and I really like his, he's got this sort of swoopy, elegant, kind of elliptical map of the London tube system as well that I really like.
Mm-hmm. Now, you put, Ruth, I know that what the Boston T-Map looks like, and you put that through your design test. What did you come up with? I'm afraid to ask.
That's right. Well, so we had a really interesting opportunity because, as you mentioned, the Boston system decided they were going to let people, of all things, vote for their next T-Map. And they had already gone through a whole ton of maps and picked six top candidates. And so, yes, we ran our algorithm on all six of those top candidates, in addition to the current map. And, you know, some of them did quite well. None of them was really perfect, but you could see good things in almost all of them. And in fact, one of the ones that won was really quite nice.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Daniel in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I lived in a few different cities, and I lived in Denver, Colorado, who has a very good public transit system. And I actually worked at high school, and I taught students with disabilities to use access to public transit. I now live in Jacksonville, Florida, and it is incredibly frustrating for me because I like public transit, but the system is so wonky and it's hard to understand what's happening that I don't use it at all. Whereas in Denver, I used it all the time. Now I don't. And so it's, and along with that, I think the tool that gets used more often now is like the online trip planning tools. And since I've lived in Jacksonville, they've gone through three tools and all three of them have been relatively terrible. And it's just really frustrating to want to use public transit and feeling like it's, the systems around it aren't built to allow me to.
Yeah. Ruth or Max, reaction?
I'm sort of, it's a worldwide trend that transit systems are coming up with journey planners, especially on computers, and I think it's a very bad thing indeed, because you know, if you're sort of always taking instructions about which trains or buses to use, then you don't learn about the network. So if the system ever fails, you've learned nothing, and quite often these systems aren't very good. But what I really hate is that quite often when a transit network creates a new computer journey planner, they'll actually bury their maps, make them impossible to find. It's almost as though now they've got their computer system, they want to stop people from using these aids, which might help them learn to use the network.
Ruth, you put one of Max's curvy maps of the London Tube through your peripheral vision model. How did it do?
So we both did that, and we had done the current tube map as well. And so you should understand, a lot of what the model will tell you is which parts of the map are you expect, given a particular place that you're currently looking, like, say, a particular subway stop, what part of the map do you expect to be kind of clear at a glance? And the parts that are clear at a glance will look very similar to the original map, and the parts that aren't clear at a glance to your peripheral vision will look much more sort of smeary and almost like you're seeing them through some sort of warped glass or something like that.
Yeah.
And a lot of what makes a map good is the more of the area that where the map is clear, according to the model, the better you expect to be able to sort of see how the network works. And there's definitely a much bigger area around the place where you're pointing your eyes in Max's sort of swoopy map than in the other London tube map that we were using that was clear. So even though in many ways Max was sort of violating a lot of the unwritten or maybe even written rules about how you're supposed to design a transit map, he'd done such a careful job of it, I think, that it really ended up being quite good visually.
You know, one of the problems, I liked the maps I saw. I liked the circular map was just beautiful. But one of the trade-offs, it seems, is whether you have form or function sometimes. I mean, a lot of maps, you want to know where exactly the stop is in the city. And you want the geography to be exact. But sometimes in these new maps, it's sort of an approximation, just so you get cleaner lines and wider spaghetti to see the map better. But you're losing a little bit of the geographic specificity, aren't you?
Yeah,
yes, that's often the trade-off.
Yes, I try not to distort things too much. You can't take a map too far beyond people's comfort zones. And the current New York subway map, that's actually very geographically distorting anyway. And that's sort of worse in a way because it looks as though it's geographically accurate, but actually it's sort of quite misleading in terms of scale and things. It might sort of have you walking a journey when it's a long, long way or the opposite. So, yes, if a map looks geographical but it's not, then it can trap you.
Hmm. Yeah, Ruth, we asked our audience on Twitter, what's the easiest transit map to use? And we got a winner, and it was Washington, D.C.'s Metro.
Yes, that's right, which we then also ran our algorithm on.
Yeah.
It did do quite well.
It's let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And it did well. It's very similar looking to BART system. I think they're the same designers who created both systems.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so one thing that's interesting about that, speaking of the geographic stuff, is they had tried to make some of the parks quite visible, which, of course, are very important landmarks in D.C., and they had also made some icons for some standard tourist kind of destinations, and those actually survived very well. In addition, quite a few of the subway lines were reproduced well in peripheral vision, according to the model. If you had to point to one thing that's perhaps not ideal in that map, according to the model, it's that there's a blue line, and there's also a river that's almost the same shade of blue, which is quite confusing. I think perhaps not only in peripheral vision, I was confused for a moment myself as to whether part of the river might be a subway line.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Colin in Washington, speaking of that Washington subway. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I am a user experience designer by trade, so I work on usability for websites and mobile apps and those kinds of things. And I was wondering, to ask the guest, what does the medium of the map, so the way the user is actually looking at it, how has your research sort of determined what impact that has, right? So like if someone, are there more things we can do on a mobile phone, for example, that we couldn't do on a paper map that you might find, you know, in a metro station?
Good question. Ruth, you want to take that first?
Yes, I think for sure. I mean, one thing that might be in between going to a full-on, you don't need to see a map, we'll just tell you where to go, and having a map is that if you have a mobile device or a computer, it could keep the whole map there, but it could sort of highlight and make more salient the part of the map that you need to care about. And that might turn out to be a good idea, for instance.
You know, what we're doing with, and I tried this with Siri before I came on the air, I asked Siri take me out to Flushing, you know, from Manhattan here, and Siri painted me a nice subway map on the number 7 train. And which would be exactly the right way to go. No other ways of going were suggested. There were other routes. And so it seems like what we're doing is following what we do with our cars. We don't look at paper maps anymore, right? We just put the GPS in there, and we have no idea of the scale of what we're doing or where we're going. We just follow those directions.
That is often a problem with these small screens.
We have quite narrow roads in Britain, and we quite often get lorries getting stuck in country lanes, and they literally get jammed in, and they can't get them out again, and the sort of police have to come and help them back out. I mean, yes, you can rely on sat-nav and all these aids if you want, but it's sort of possibly not advisable to rely on them too much. You might be missing out on bad things, or you might be missing out on sort of tricks that the computer doesn't realize you can do.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like this is sort of the future. I'm using the car analogy. More and more people are using that. Do we have to make better apps then for mass transit?
Well, it all depends on what you want people to do. If you just want to get from A to B by the way they're told to do, then yes, right, give them apps. But if you want people to learn about the city, how it fits together, that, you know, the whole city. You know, when I was young, I sort of in my teens, I use a huge London bus map, just learn every square inch of London. It's quite a sort of achievement when you're a teenager, just go out and explore like that. And I don't think I'd have learnt nearly so much. And you know, it's turned out to be useful knowledge. It's your big cities, it's good to know where all the neighborhoods are and how to navigate them.
I think there is absolute beauty in looking at a big map of things, no matter what it is. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more on the science of design, map design, Ruth Rosenholz and Max Roberts. Your questions, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour on the science of map design and what makes a good subway map. We got some tweets coming in. Let's tweet from Jeff, who says, "I'm still waiting for a colorblind friendly transit map." How about that one? And people writing in saying, "I live both in New York and San Francisco. They have equally bad designs." I've traveled all over the world. Someone else has in Tokyo. They think Tokyo has the best transit map. So Madrid is pretty good, someone says. Let's talk about one of your map studies, Max, about you designed what you called a curvy map of Paris. Why did you do that?
Yes, it's like the London curvy map. I mean, there's one of the things a transit map should do is make things simple. It should take sort of complicated, twisting routes in real life and actually make them sort of simple straight lines so they're easy to follow. And the trouble with the official Paris map is it doesn't do that. It takes the complexities of reality and then turns it to zigzags instead. So it's not actually simplified Paris. It's just changed the shape of the complexity. So my reasoning was, well, let's, you know, all these harsh zigzags, you know, 16 corners from end to end on line 4, you know, just try and smooth them out. Just try and ease out the shape, you know, give Paris a bit of shape, show the loop lines and everything. Mm-hmm. And that curvilinear map's actually very good. It's every time we compare it against the official map, it comes out as sort of 50% faster. So a journey it takes 30 seconds to plan on the official map, a user can do that in 20 seconds on the curvilinear map. But even so, the curvilinear map's not popular because people say, well, it's obviously the wrong way to design a map, so it must be hard to use. But it's actually wrong. It's the it's the easier map.
Huh. And how did your Paris curvy map do in your testing? You said it was a lot faster? How much faster was it?
50% faster.
50%? That's pretty
good. Yes.
And that's when you say faster, that's how much faster you could just look at the map and see where you want to go.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the time to plan a journey. And when you think about all the tourists in Paris, that's those sort of extra seconds add up to sort of thousands of years every year.
Ruth, you put one of Max's curvy maps of the London Tube through your peripheral vision model.
Yes, that's right.
Did it love it?
So we had it. We did the model as if you were looking at one of the stops in central London, figuring that would be sort of a reasonable scenario and so on. And often we think of it as if these big straight lines are the best for maps. But I think if you do these curvy lines in the right way, you can be as good or better as having a bunch of just straight lines in the map. It did quite well.
Now let's go to the phone, see if we can get a quick call in from Matt in Baltimore. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey there.
I'm a huge fan of Science Friday. I actually lived in Seoul for a couple of years ago, and one of the things that I really liked about their metro system maps was when you were actually on the train, there was a different entire map to display just the area, just the line that you were on. So each line had its own shape, and it was reflected on the independent map inside of the train. So I lived on the Green Line, which is the circular line in Seoul. So I got to know really well the shape of the city from going off of my line and then further out into each different line that was crossing.
But you could see other subway lines meeting yours?
Yeah, you would only see the connections, though. You wouldn't actually have to look at all of the different stations that were coming off of it. You would just see those independent lines.
Oh, thanks for that call. You know, one of the things about these connections, Max and Ruth, is there are these little white dots, you know, for like black dots, and they're tiny little dots. These are almost impossible to make out when you're running very quickly. Is there a better system than that?
So in the Boston contest for the T-Maps, we saw a couple of interesting alternatives. I mean, first of all, I think some of them had really nice kind of large dots showing the stops. And in fact, you can see that in the DC Metro maps, that they're actually very salient. And again, the model predicts that they're actually visible from quite far away. And another map had little bumps on the side of the line instead of holes in the middle of the line. And you might not think that would necessarily make such a big difference, but those bumps are very visible in peripheral vision. And furthermore, they actually seem to help by not having holes in the line along the one of the lines. It keeps it from sort of breaking up.
Yeah, well, we're going to wait for the ultimate subway maps. I think we'll have to wait a little bit longer because it's going to take a while. Ruth Rosenholz, Principal Research Scientist in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT. Max Roberts, Transit Map Researcher, Lecturer in Psychology, University of Essex in the UK. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can see all the maps we talked about today on our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/transit maps. No, there's nothing wrong with your radio. That sound means it's the Science Club. Science Club is back in session. Just 2 weeks ago, we challenged you to come up with a device that could get a message from point A to point B, not using a cell phone. That was one of the rules that we made. And boy, did you rise to the occasion. Here to talk about how some of you solved our message challenge are the two founding members of the Science Club. Ariel Zitch, Charles Berquist, welcome back.
Thanks, Ariel.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Ariel, remind us what the contest was all about.
Well, as you said, we wanted folks to create some sort of device that got a message from point A to point B. And we really didn't want cheaters, right? So we didn't want you to use a communication device to communicate. We wanted you to hack or invent something that did that. And so, we left it pretty open. We also didn't specify, like, what modality people used or how far it went. And we got some really interesting submissions.
Yeah, Charles, a lot of people?
Yeah, dozens of submissions from all over. And as Ariel said, they really ranged from, some people were using light or sound. Some people were physically flinging things from one place to the other. One team even had this robot that crawled along a line drawn on the floor of their classroom to physically carry a note sneakily from one person to the other.
And they can see all these submissions on our website?
That's right. They're up on our website at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub.
Ariel, I know you're such an education geek.
Yes.
What were some of your favorite submissions?
Well, I think the ones that were my favorite were probably the ones that were the most surprising. So I watched a bunch of girls put a message that was wrapped around a marble into a pool noodle, so these, like, giant foam noodles, which I didn't know were hollow, but they're hollow. And then they took a balloon that had been fully inflated and used it to force air out the noodle and shoot the marble with the message out the other side, which is pretty cool. I really enjoyed seeing kind of these, again, these kind of hack devices, right? So this idea that, taking a robot that you've already done. So we had this computer science class, computer integrated manufacturing class from Jordan Elbridge High, where they had already engineered this robot and said, hey, we can actually create a little cart for it and have it tote around a message during class. It was pretty awesome.
And Charles, your favorite?
Probably one of my favorites was a group of, I believe there were seventh graders who built a crossbow out of some rulers and pencils. And you would think, okay, or maybe it'll fling something from one side of the desk to the other. They had this thing outside in their school parking lot, and it probably went a good 30 or 40 feet.
That was incredibly impressive. Like, when we watched that, both of us were like, whoa!
Well, they were just trying to emulate you, Charles. You're the star on the web there with your... Describe what you made.
It was basically an air-powered rocket made out of some PVC pipe, and it almost took the head off of our social media guru, Brandon Ector, one day in the office. But yeah, there were people coming up with all kinds of solutions.
Mm-hmm. And we have on the line with us someone who really came up with a lot of solutions. Karen Hattis, she's a fourth grade teacher at Ann Arbor STEAM, one of the Ann Arbor public schools in Michigan. And her students participated in the challenge in a big way. She sent in a bunch of entries. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, how are you doing?
There were a bunch of approaches that were sort of like projection boxes.
Hello?
Hello, are you there?
Yeah, I am. It just, you cut out for a minute. Oh. Yeah, we had dozens of different ideas that the kids came up with. It was three fourth grade classrooms, mine along with Heather Bibbleson and Emma Huntley's. We had like 18 creative teams come up with a bunch of different ideas. We started off with the concept, how can we transfer information using light and sound? And we actually started our project a month before we saw the Science Club Challenge. So it was really cool to see that kind of come up and the kids could kind of share their ideas.
Yeah, and there were other groups that went to a more code-making route. Did any of them just not work?
We had one group that started off with the idea they wanted to do a dance code, and so the group was coming up with dance moves that they wanted to stand for different letters, and it got too complex for them. They couldn't manage it. So they had to kind of go back to the drawing board, but they created a new code, and they decided to use light and color instead of dance moves. So they did a great job with their revision.
Hmm.
I think that's just outstanding. I mean, one of the things that we hear, Karen, all the time about code, I mean, even in common communication now, is that codes are revised constantly, right? So your students kind of did that anyway. I'm curious, did you guys notice in your students that as they did this project, they had any change of heart or change of perspective?
Well, I think two things. I think they really became aware about how light and sound and patterns are used all over the place. You know, we talked about like encryptions and how banks use them. A team became fascinated with like fiber optics, and so we did a lot of research and they did a lot of discovery. And I think with the engineering process, they really learned how valuable feedback and revision is, and that was really powerful for, you know, 9-year-olds to know I need to go back and keep working and changing what I'm doing, and I can make it better.
Outstanding.
Mm-hmm. Charles?
I think one of my favorites that the students came up with, it was a bike helmet with a reflector on top. It looked almost like a satellite dish or something like that. And then
there was a light bulb
in the middle. And
the old Al Franken helmet.
Yeah, it looked sort of like that old Saturday Night Live skit. But the student was using it to flash messages across the room at each other.
I loved that.
They did a lot of studying of like what's already out there, so they were like adapting Morse code, and like semaphore flag code was a really popular thing that, you know, started sparking their own imagination.
Yeah, so you're pretty happy how creative they were, Karen.
Oh, they were fantastic. Yes, I was really impressed. We had a huge expo night about 2 days ago in our school, that's K-7, and they were able to present to the community and parents. It was fantastic.
Wow. And do you think they'll keep doing it even though the contest is over?
Oh, absolutely. They're obsessed with secret codes and all that kind of stuff. Now, I'm sure they're going to keep on going with it.
Well, we wish you great luck, and thank you for all the stuff. We have all that stuff up there on our website and even on YouTube and Twitter and all kinds of places. Thank you very much, and congratulate your kids for us. They did a great job.
Oh, they absolutely did, and I will. Thank you.
Karen Haddis is a fourth-grade teacher at Ann Arbor STEAM. That's one of the Ann Arbor public schools in Michigan. Ara, this wasn't just schools, though, right?
Not at all. Actually, we had schools, yes. We also had homeschools. So there's a homeschool group that spent the whole day on these projects, catapults, balloon rockets, all the things to send messages. We also had some adults who put together some really interesting apparatus. So David and Laura, who are a couple of amateur radio station buffs in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, they put together, they used an Arduino light package. You can get these guys,
yeah.
You can program it, right?
Yeah.
They used it to actually Morse code a grocery list, which, you kind of get the impression they're like sending some message when you watch the video on our site, but I dare all of you to check this out because you probably can crack the code and figure out what they needed to buy at the grocery.
No need to crack our code. We're Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about the Science Club, Ariel Zitch and Charles Berquist. Yeah, it's amazing how creative some of these people are.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes you could tell it was like in the moment. So there was a family that created a pumpkin-based catapult. So they had a whole front yard set up. They used a pumpkin to anchor this catapult and pulled it back in a princess dress. I'd like to remind everyone that you can be an engineer in a princess dress. It doesn't matter. And sent eggs, those little, you know, plastic eggs,
right,
with messages inside all the way across the lawn.
Charles, did it matter how big the message was?
No, we didn't have any requirements on what people had to say. A lot of the messages that people were sending were just things like, hi. But one entry from a gentleman named Fred did helpfully calculate out for us the bandwidth involved in strapping a little USB drive onto this cable car that ran across a string through his room. And I think he probably won for the greatest bandwidth entry.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Were people working on it as a project, two or three kids or families?
Yeah,
or?
It could be in groups. It could be individually. I mean, like what I like to see, and I think this is kind of exciting to think about as you go into the holidays, is like you look around and realize you can communicate with anyone with anything, right? So when you guys are sitting at your ultra-long Thanksgiving table, maybe you can come up with a cool device that sends that message across the table to say, pass the salt. I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, my dad used to have a nice stare that sent a message across the table. There was no ambiguity about that. Are we going to have another science club?
Yes, absolutely.
Of course we are.
Stay tuned with us in the spring. We've got some big stuff planned. If you've got ideas for a science club that you'd like to see happen, you can email us at scienceclub@sciencefriday.com. Or, of course, tweet us at SciFry. Of course, if you're still planning on working on it this weekend, we'd love to see any submissions you're wrapping wrapping up. And yeah, stay tuned.
Yeah. And of course, if you want to see these projects, they're all up there on our website.
They're all up on our website. We've got a big gallery of them at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub. And you can get up there and see that pumpkin catapult, see the satellite dish on the kid's head, all kinds of stuff.
I want to know what your kids, I know you have children, what were they thinking when Dad was on the floor doing all those projects?
They just wanted to steal the rocket and start shooting it around the backyard. I mean, you know,
did
they get?
Did you ask them to do any of the challenge themselves?
They did not. They actually had a lot of homework that day. So this was Dad's homework while they worked on their homework.
All right. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Science Friday's education manager, Ariel Zitch, and our director, Charles Berquist, founding members of the Science Club. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And hey, would you mind passing some science with that cranberry sauce? We've compiled some great Thanksgiving science stories from big balloons to turkey snoods. Check out the spotlight at sciencefriday.com/Thanksgiving. And next week being Thanksgiving, it's time for our annual Ig Nobel Prize Award ceremony. I heard you all in your cars yelling that at me. So, yes, we're going to have our special that we have every year. We've gone to the Ig Nobel Prize ceremonies, and we've got a special hour for you. And we'll also have some surprises in the other hour. So we'll say goodbye and wish you a happy Thanksgiving. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.